All right. Our last case for this morning is United States against Snodgrass, 10-23-43. And we'll hear from Mr. Welby.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Steve Welby here for Mr. Snodgrass. Mr. Snodgrass was convicted of three counts, one for attempted receipt of child pornography, and then when the officers raided his home, they found additional items that the jury determined to be child pornography, and he was convicted of two counts of possession. This is a relatively straightforward case. There are three points that I've asked the Court to review, the first being the statement that the judge allowed, the defendant's statement that he made to the postal inspectors. I think the judge erred in finding that the defendant was not in custody at that time. I think if you look at the circumstances surrounding the questioning, it is clear that his freedom was deprived, his freedom of action had been deprived, and it's based primarily on the police-dominated environment in which he was found.
He's in his laundry room, though, right?
Not his laundry room, Your Honor.
Common room in the...
Correct. He lived in a small apartment. It actually had been some sort of railroad hotel that had been converted to apartments. He was removed from his home by the agents after being searched. While other agents were searching his home, there's child pornography under the facts found by the jury. Lying on his desk and sitting in his computer, he's taken from his home. His wallet had been taken from him. They took him down to put him in this laundry room, which was in the same building.
But it's a public room, right? Anybody else in the building could
go in? That is correct, Your Honor. The room in which he was questioned was available to other people that could have come there to wash their clothes, other residents of that same complex, not
a grocery store. Even assuming he was in custody, he signed a Miranda waiver.
Well, that's the second issue. The first, the Miranda is not important at all unless the court should find that he was in custody.
Right.
My issue with the Miranda waiver is that it wasn't a voluntary waiver of those rights, and I think you see that not only from his testimony or from the testimony of the officers, which the defendant himself said that he was intimidated by the questioning, but there's a repeated conduct on his part of refusing to sign the offer, and he's not allowed to leave. He's not told he's free to leave.
None of that is required for a valid Miranda waiver.
I'm sorry?
None of that is required for a valid Miranda waiver. There was no evidence of coercion here.
I believe the coercion doesn't have to be simply physical coercion, but it can be a product of intimidation.
Yeah, there's no evidence of intimidation either.
I would respectfully disagree. I understand.
What evidence of intimidation is there?
Your Honor, the officers took him from the home. It's just like the intimidation that was present in the Slate case. They took him from his home while it was being searched. The judge Easterbrook found in that case that they had the goods on the guy because the child pornography was right there.
In Slate, the defendant was taken to the police station and put in an interrogation room.
It is correct.
This is not remotely comparable.
I think this is
within steps of his apartment. There's really no evidence of coercion at all here.
Well,
other than his own claim that he was intimidated, but there isn't any evidence of coercive activity on the part of the officers.
Well, I think you have to look at the defendant's background. I think you have to look at the circumstances surrounding the questioning, the conditions in which he's questioned, and then the last issue is whether there's any physical coercion. Looking at the first two factors, you have a man that has no prior criminal history, his academic record does not indicate that he is even average intelligence. He has no work history that would support a finding that he has any type of experience in the situation whatsoever. The circumstances surrounding this are very...
You might want to move to your sentencing issue. There really is no evidence to support a claim that this is a coerced confession in this case.
I'll move on then, Your Honor. With respect to the sentencing, I think the question we're presented here is whether or not the sentence was reasonable. The defendant received a sentence of 30 years, but for the uncharged conducts and the enhancements filed both with the guidelines and the variances applied by the court, the defendant was looking at a sentence of roughly 10 years for the conduct for which he was charged, prosecuted, and convicted. Relying on hearsay evidence...
Which is okay at sentencing, if it's reliable.
Well, the big problem with this case, Your Honor, is each one of these things individually is okay. But when you put them all together, you end up with a sentence that is just completely unreasonable. You have uncharged conduct proven by hearsay, and hearsay is what other courts have found to be the least reliable form. It's government-initiated contact with these individuals, conveying information of past events with no opportunity to cross-examine any of the people who provide this hearsay information. And all this leads to a judicial fact-finding completely separate from what the jury heard the case about and what the jury found happened at the trial. And the judicial fact-finding is used to enhance the guidelines, which other courts have drawn into question.
Well, what the judge is doing, I mean, he's obviously looking at the guidelines, as he must, but he's also looking at the 3553A factors. And the standard of review we have to apply to judicial fact-finding of the sort that you describe is, first of all, of course, there has to be reliability, if not formal evidentiary admissibility in the evidence. And then we have clear error standards of review. It's very deferential review.
I mean,
that's the system Congress has given us.
I understand, and I'm not trying to minimize the difficulty of my argument. I realize that.
We recognize what you're saying. It's a very long sentence, no doubt about that, but it's within the statutory criteria that Congress has laid out.
And my final point on that, Your Honor, is that I believe Mr. Snodgrass had the right to have this information provided to him at the time of sentencing. He was...
The information that the judge was going to rely on.
The 3553 determinations, the basis for which the judge gave him this significant enhancement. There was an objection filed as to the uncharged conduct that was used.
And you're basically talking about the prior acts of actual child abuse.
Yes, that was we objected to that evidence at the hearing. It was presented by way of hearsay testimony from the agent and two videotapes that were played to the court. And there were some other videotapes that were played that were seized from the defendant. At the hearing itself, though, the judge simply told Mr. Snodgrass, you're a sicko, you're evil, or words to that effect, and sentenced him to 30 years in prison, a 10-year upward departure. That's the oral pronouncement of sentence. That's what the public has a right to rely on, and that's what Mr. Snodgrass has a right to rely on. Then there's later some post hoc justifications provided by the court, breaking down the 3553 analysis, but it's my contention that the defendant and the public and the system at large had a right to have the judge tell the defendant right there in open court, this is why I'm giving you this sentence, and this is the basis for the sentence. Whether it's attached to a memo or filed a week, 2 weeks, or 3 months later, I think you have to look at the oral pronouncement of sentence, and I think the judge erred by refusing to do that and by denying Mr. Snodgrass the right to be told in open court at the pronouncement of sentence the basis for which he was giving this enhancement.
All right. You can save a little time for rebuttal if you like.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Likens.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Tom Likens, and I represent the United States in this appeal. I was not the attorney at trial. Nor was I the attorney on the brief, but I think I am prepared to answer any questions the court might have. Given the court's opinion that there is no evidence of a coerced confession in this case, and if you have no questions of me on that issue, I will just move directly to the sentencing issue. Of course, the standard in this case is whether or not the sentence the court imposed was reasonable. The defendant's guideline range was 235 to 240 months. And the court applied a variance and imposed a sentence of 360 months.
Well, actually, I should just, of course, assure everyone that we will look at all the issues. We often explore things in oral argument from many perspectives. But I have a question for you about the sentencing, which is to what extent the pre-sentence report alerted Mr. Snodgrass to the range of behavior that the district judge was going to look at.
There were four or five paragraphs in the pre-sentence investigation report, which would have put in which Mr. Snodgrass filed objections to, which put him on notice that this type of this specific information was being relied upon by the probation office to give him a four-level enhancement under the guidelines.
So this is the material you're describing around 32, 33, of your brief.
Yes.
Yeah.
The and what the and in considering the reasonableness of the sentence the court imposed, the court took into consideration that this defendant had molested several children, that he had molested several, at least three generations of his own family members, that he had over 7,000 images on his computer, and that the guidelines stop at 600. Once you have 600 images, you cannot get more time under the guidelines.
I have to say the guidelines are grossly out of date in that respect, if our cases are anything, because in the Internet era, it's really not, I mean, we've seen lots of cases with 7,000. I think the issue that bothers me about these huge sentences is that of marginal deterrence. You know, is this defendant really at the top of the scale in this very seamy world of child pornography, or is he, or are they all at the top of the scale? I mean, in other words, it's really troublesome. We give these gigantic sentences, and then if somebody's got 20,000 images, what do we do?
I believe what was driving the court, there was a combination of things driving the court. The court also made reference to the fact that the guidelines will only let you enhance someone for two instances of molestation, and the government put on evidence of four instances in this case. I think what was particularly worrisome to the court wasn't just that this was someone who was downloading and collecting child pornography, but that he was a predator, and that if you look at the court's comments at sentencing and his amplification at the record document 88, he was really concerned that this defendant was a predator, and that if he didn't do something to put him in jail until he was old enough where he wouldn't be a predator any longer, then he would continue to do exactly that. If he got out at an age when he could still be, as the court said, a scourge on society, he would do so.
Yeah, I mean, it's some of the language the court uses is a little too subjective and personal, I think. I mean, certainly he could say, you know, 3553A itself calls on me to choose a sentence that will protect the rest of society from you, from your bad behavior. And I understand that's what the court was doing. Calling somebody a sicko doesn't really advance much. If he's really mentally ill, maybe you shouldn't even sentence him for that. But, you know, keeping it professional is helpful.
Well, I believe the judge's supplemental statement of reasons at Record Document 88 is more tempered and is certainly more. The judge lets the court know exactly what it was he was thinking without the interjection as you said, some terms that might be, you know, incendiary, for lack of a better word. But I think the court was, when you look at the totality, the court was concerned primarily that what he was dealing with here was not the run-of-the-mill person who collects child pornography. He was dealing with someone who was a predator and who was a danger to society, and he imposed a sentence to reflect that. And if there are no further questions from the court, I will yield the rest of my time.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Welby?
And at the height of the Abu Ghraib scandal, there was questions posed to the international press as to what the president knew and what the Congress knew, and, you know, why are there all these problems with the government, and is there anything that our government does right? And the answer provided by the international press was that the United States federal judiciary is respected around the world, both by friend and foe. If you look at the sentence that took place in this case, if you look at the process by which a man was charged with very specific crimes and faced a harsh sentence for that crime, but instead was sentenced for conduct for which he was never tried, for which he was never charged, and for which the jury never heard a single piece of evidence, and was enhanced both under the guidelines and in a variance, the only reasonable conclusion that you can find is that that sentence, the sentence of 30 years, is substantively unreasonable, and I'm asking the court to reverse it and remand for resentencing. We would also ask for a new trial based on the other issues raised in the appeals. And I thank you all.
Thank you very much. And you were appointed as well, as I understand. We appreciate very much your efforts on behalf of your client and for the court. Thank you. And thank you, too. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.